Good afternoon, everyone. It's, welcome to the Bapsi Banu Marchioness of Winchester Lecture for 2017. It's a delight to see you all here. And it's our very great pleasure to have with us today Professor Sandra Harding. So Sandra Harding is Distinguished Research Professor of Education and Gender Studies at UCLA Graduate School for Education and Information Studies. And she is a renowned philosopher of feminist theory, philosophy of science, and post-colonial thought. She's probably best known for her work on standpoint epistemology, especially for developing the notion of strong objectivity. And over her career, she has authored many articles and some 17 books, including most recently this one, Objectivity and Diversity, some themes from which she's going to be developing for us this afternoon. So we're very honoured and delighted to have Sandra with us, but at risk of perhaps injecting a slightly sadder tone, I did just want to note that this was a visit that I arranged with Professor Pamela Anderson before she sadly passed away in March. And I think it's important to record that fact and to take a moment to remember her wonderful spirit, her philosophical talents, and of course her very great contributions over the years to the cause of women in philosophy here in Oxford. Anyway, that's enough from me, so I will pass you over and ask you to join me in welcoming Professor Sandra Harding, and the topic of her talk this afternoon is After Mr. Nowhere, New Proper Philosophic Selves.
Thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me. It's a great honor. I want to also take a moment to remember Pamela Anderson. I'm so sad that she's not here. She and I were colleagues for a year, 28 years ago, at the University of Delaware. And she, I think, had graduated from Oxford and, of course, returned to it. And it was she who organized for me a visit to four British campuses a year and a half ago, and again was unable to. I was unable to see her because she had gotten sick again. So we were emailing and looking forward to this time, and I'm thinking of her a lot as I'm here. Okay, so after Mr. Nowhere, New Proper Philosophic Selves. The social justice movements that began in the 1960s, some of them had older roots, all had scientific and epistemological projects. The civil rights movement, poor people's movements, feminist movements, post-colonial movements, lesbian, gay, bi, trans, queer movements, disability movements, and then moving forward, the Arab Spring, Occupy, all of these social justice movements have had scientific projects. In each case, they needed kinds of knowledge, kinds of information, in order to get greater control over their lives, the lives of the people they represented, than was available from mainstream science and philosophy of science. They understood what is the founding principle of the field of the social studies of scientific knowledge, namely, sciences and their societies co-produce each other. A racist society will produce racist sciences that further legitimate and provide resources for a racist society. A sexist society will produce sexist sciences that further support the sexist society. In the field of social studies of scientific knowledge, this was articulated by Sheila Jasanoff, in particular, in several of her books. And so this view that sciences and their societies co-produce each other is opposed to the view that Mr. Nowhere represents, namely the conventional view that maximally valuable scientific or philosophic claims must have no social, political, economic values and interests shaping them. The goal of objectivity in these areas is value and interest-free results of research. As Donna Haraway put the point, and I apologize if this is a little blasphemous, the conventional view always tried to perform the God trick of seeing everywhere in the world from no particular location in it. These social justice movements have produced new methodologies of research. I'm not saying methods. I'm not talking about research methods. I'm talking about theories of how to go about doing research that produces reliable results. And so I want to read a short passage here by the historians Lorraine Daston and Peter Gallison. It comes from their book entitled Objectivity. And that book is a study of the history of atlases of violets of the world, of flamingos of the world, and so forth. These atlases were, as they point out, the internet of their day. They permitted scientists separated by time or by space. They permitted them to work together. The scientist could take his atlas of orchids of the world into the Amazon and, seeing an unfamiliar little flower, check out if it fit one of the images in the atlas and whether it was a new discovery or simply an example of an older one. And these atlases, the standard for them using these atlases was true to life. It was not to be objective, but to be true to life. And hotel rooms, at least in the U.S., this isn't true of my room here, frequently have images from those atlases. The orchid with a perfect orchid. Every leaf is perfect. Every little flower petal is perfect. The background is white. There is no broken leaves, no shadows over it, no rabbit dung at the bottom, right? It's a perfect, true to nature image. These models of true to nature, Daston and Gallison are showing, began to be replaced by our conventional notion of objectivity around the middle of the 19th century, when mechanical modes of representation became possible. The camera was the most obvious one, but there were all kinds of medical technologies and others that automatically recorded nature. And the scientists who had to testify with respect to the earlier true to nature images, that the engraver had not introduced any aesthetic elements in it or his own ideas about what an orchid looked like. The scientist signed it on the back. They no longer had to do that, they thought. This was long before Photoshop and Soviet erasure of now unwanted colleagues from various formal portraits, right? So we were not so naive about the powers of the camera to actually represent what was there. Okay, so here's the quotation about objectivity. What is the nature of objectivity? First and foremost, objectivity is the suppression of some aspect of the self, the countering of subjectivity. Objectivity and subjectivity define each other like left and right or up and down. One cannot be understood, even conceived, without the other. If objectivity was summoned into existence to negate subjectivity, the emergence of objectivity must tally with the emergence of a certain kind of willful self, one perceived as endangering scientific knowledge. The history of objectivity becomes, ipso facto, part of the history of the self, or more precisely, of the proper scientific self. So my discussion today is going to be about the new kinds of proper scientific and philosophic philosophy of science selves that have been created by the new research methodologies of the social justice movements. And I'm going to begin by probably boring half of you and mystifying the other half by briefly reviewing what standpoint theory does, how it works, and then turn to three examples of the proper scientific self that I identified in my last book, and then move on to one I'm thinking about today that's quite different, that I think anthropologists have a lot to say. I'm stealing from anthropologists here, so I'm expecting some good questions from them. Okay, so standpoint theory, I'm going to call it a methodology, traces its origins to Hegel's thoughts about the relationship between what the slave knows and the master knows. The master sees the slave always smiling, right, always saying yes sir, and is unaware of the fact that the slave is in fact planning that night to kill him and run away. They have different relationships to knowledge. Marx, of course, picked this up in the standpoint of the proletariat. And in the late 1960s and early 1970s, feminists developed it most articulately, overtly, I guess I should say, as the standpoint of women or the feminist standpoint. And some of the key figures here were the Canadian sociologist of knowledge, Dorothy Smith, the British sociologist of science, Hilary Rose, the U.S. political theorist, Nancy Hartsock, and I worked on it, and so did U.S. philosopher Alison Jagger. So standpoint theory in this feminist and, as I'll shortly point out, more general formation from the 1970s, says, start off research projects not from the dominant conceptual framework in your field, but from the daily lives of vulnerable groups. What kinds of questions arise, for example, in women's daily lives? I'll use women as the example here. That's the first thing to do. Start off your research questions not from dominant sociological theories about women and men, not from political theories, anthropological theories, educational theories, but from what kinds of questions arise from their lives, in their lives. That would be questions both that they themselves ask and that you, the observer, can identify, even though they don't ask it. Right? They might not exactly formulate their issues in the kinds of ways that you can. But that's just the first step of standpoint theory, because ethnographers have always done something like that. They've tried to understand other people's lives in their terms. The second step is to study up, that is, to look up at the dominant institutions whose daily operations and policies and practices have shaped everybody's lives, and from which the dominated groups have been excluded. So it's not women who design World Bank theory, right? And there are more women involved, powerful feminist economists involved in the World Bank, but this is now, not back in the 1970s. And the World Bank is still has a ways to go to get to its feminist potential. So to understand the dominant institutions and how they, what is it that they do that creates these conditions in the lives of everyone, and in the cases we're looking at, in women's lives. Third and most importantly is to understand the relationship between those dominant institutions and women's lives. I've pointed out how we want to know how those institutions shape women's lives, but how do women's lives shape those institutions? How does the fact that the leaders, people like me who are a crossover to the professorate, which is a man's job originally, don't have to do the daily work of taking care of our bodies, the bodies of other generations, cleaning these rooms. When I come into a classroom in the US, I drag out my dusty notes from the last time I taught the class, re-xerox them, walk into the class, and it turns out that everybody in that class is supposed to be there. How did that happen? Not through my efforts, but through all the staff of the universities, their therapists, all the people it took to get those students in that room. The room's clean. I didn't clean it, right? Everybody's well fed, they're dressed and dressed appropriately. I had nothing to do with that, well, more or less appropriately. The fact that dominant groups don't have to take care of their physical selves, other people's physical selves, or the physical places, or for that matter, emotional places where people live, allows them to develop very abstract and distorted understandings of social relations. So starting off from the everyday lives of vulnerable groups enables one to understand not only those groups' lives in their terms, not only the dominant institutions in the terms of the vulnerable group, but also the established social relations and practices that constitute the social order. I've been talking about, using as examples, women, but I started out by pointing to social justice movements. And in fact, the logic of this kind of methodology has been adopted by every social movement. We've learned so much about ableism from the disability movement that I never understood. And I could go through the whole list of those social movements. The first thing we see here is that values and interests that are culturally, historically shared are very difficult to identify by normal research practices. How do normal research practices maximize objectivity, the objectivity of the results of research? In lots of ways. But one key element is to repeat observations across individuals or laboratories or research groups, right? And so if I do a piece of research and publish the results, and Dan tries to replicate it, he tries to reproduce what I did, and he comes up with different results and publishes them, you all can read the published reports and say that happened because Sandra was making racist assumptions and Dan was not. Okay, so normal standards for objectivity work very well when values and interests differ between individuals or laboratories or field sites. They don't work well if Dan and I are both ableist or Eurocentric. There's nothing in that process that's going to, and if you all are too, there's nothing in that process that's going to enable the identification of those social values and interests that have shaped the research project. And it's those shared values and interests that are the most powerful ones, precisely because we can't see them. They're the air we breathe. I never understood I was ableist until the disability movement came along. So here's a second problem. Evidently, So the first problem with the conventional notions of good science, how to do good science, is that they don't have the resources to identify social, political, economic values and interests shared across groups, and sometimes 500 years in the whole world, right? I mean, really broadly shared. Secondly, they say, the standard procedures say, if you find a social or political or economic value or interest, such as the one Sandra Harding just committed, evidently, in her racist research, get rid of it. You must get rid of all social, political values and interests that shape the results of research. Yet we can see in the examples I started out with, the social justice movements, that those research projects were shaped by specific historical, social, political values and interests. Okay, ableism wasn't always around. It took a huge politics for the disability movement to be able to make its voices heard in research and policy circles. It's still working at it. And the same is true for every other such social movement. So it can't be that all social and political values and interests have the same bad effects on research projects. This leads us to a different kind of question. Which values and interests advance research and which block it? Okay, so that's a different kind of question than the one we had in the conventional notion. Now, I'm not saying that every feminist claim is automatically true. I'm sure there's one or two somewhere that have not managed to pass that test. It's not saying that they're invincible, that they're automatically always true. That certainly isn't the case for any human claims. So the point, rather, is to try to identify and subject them, these claims that come out of social justice movements, to a kind of critical inquiry that is respectful of them and their possibilities for advancing knowledge without presuming that they're always right. I'll just point out that scientific method never gets us truths. And philosophy of science knows that. It regards methods that get automatically truths as dogmas. And I hesitate to say that in this building, but you know what I mean. The best scientific method ever gets is results of research that are less false than all and only the other hypotheses tested as of today. Okay, and that's a benefit. Some people have described science as great, modern Western science as great resources, as the fact that it's a falsity machine. It intends to find where the limits are of various hypotheses, where they apply and where they don't. It wants to produce falsehoods to mark those limits and find the range within which Copernican, you know, one astronomy works and another doesn't. Okay, so let me turn now to my main argument here, which is about new proper scientific selves and philosophy of science selves. The social justice research, for those of you who've read that latest book, Objectivity and Diversity, Another Logic of Scientific Research, I identified three, and I'm going to here turn to a fourth also. The three I identified are, first, multiple and conflicted scientific selves. The model for Mr. Nowhere is a single figure that's coherent, right? It doesn't hold contradictory tensions within it. This figure has arrived at a confidence as full as is possible in his or her self as a scientist, right? And is not holding contradictory beliefs. That's not the case with the research coming out of the new social justice movements. And I'm going to take some examples here that I hope you're familiar with. How many people know Gloria Ansel Dua's work, Borderlands? Whoops. Okay, W.E.B. Du Bois, Double Vision of African. Okay, we're getting there. So Ansel Dua is a Latin American theorist. She's lesbian and yet loves her homophobic father and mother and brother. She's a feminist and yet needs to bond with and does bond with her patriarchal father and brother in their race struggles. And the borderland she lives on is Texas and Mexico, right? Where there are different languages on different sides of the border, different cultures and so forth. There's something like, somebody counted, I think 38 borders that Ansel Dua describes in her book entitled La Frontera Borderlands. W.E.B. Du Bois much earlier had pointed to the double vision that African Americans must have. On the one hand, they must understand white society because it has huge effects on them. And on the other hand, they understand black African American society in ways the white society can't possibly understand it. They must keep one eye on each all the time. Early feminist arguments can be found that are similar. We called it the problem of the hyphen. Everybody was a liberal feminist, a socialist feminist, a Catholic feminist, a Jewish feminist, and so forth. We always had this double identity. And they were conflicted. Liberalism was not including women. That's why there needed to be liberal feminism. It was not including women in the way feminists wanted. And the same for Catholic feminism and so forth. And yet we came to understand that the great creativity of feminist theory came precisely from the hyphen. It came precisely from that space between where the two policies and practices and theories created friction with each other. Thus, a proper scientific self for a feminist or for Du Bois or for Ansel Dua is a person who can hold in balance these sometimes contradictory, certainly conflictual relations. When I talk about this to my students at UCLA, which is a heavily Latin American and Asian American, 70% of the undergrads are either Latin American or Asian American, they get it immediately because they feel a loyalty to their home, their grandparents, their family, and yet we're paid to turn them into fundamentally good white citizens of the U.S., right? Who know how to do good scientific, sociological, philosophic, whatever research. And they want it and value it, but they also feel a loss and a friction with the values and interests that are so important to them in many ways. And they speak about the pain of that divided self. But they also understand that they have to be there. There's no escape. They're there. And so they learn, hopefully, through many of our classes about how to work with that in a way that's a little less painful. So that's one kind of new proper scientific self I see coming out of these new standpoint methodologies. A second one, and I'm not saying these are completely separate, they frequently overlap with each other. Single people can represent, be part of all of them. A second kind of new proper scientific self is a strategic researcher who figures out exactly how to locate her research in a certain social world, rather than trying to locate it outside those social worlds, right? Do the God trick and see everywhere in the world from no particular place at all. And this strategy actually will be known to most people through the history of participatory action research, which was developed, I think, in the 1960s. At least the US stories talk about it that way. Developed in the 1960s to give poor people a voice in the war on poverty that the federal government was instituting at that time. And so the idea was to start off with an existing advocacy group and pursue the issues that they needed for their goals to be met. So people worked with the civil rights movement groups, right, with poor people's groups, with feminist groups, and so forth, to try to provide answers to the questions that were important to these groups. So it's participatory action research, and it's social science students today are routinely trained into it. One very radical end of it, end of the spectrum of such movements, is collaborative research. And I use the word collaborative here not in the way it's conventionally used, particularly in the natural sciences, to mean when a biologist and a physicist work together, but rather when there's a collaboration between the researcher and the, so to speak, objects of research. It emerged most powerfully out of archaeology, when it became no longer okay to drag somebody's ancestors' bones out of the ground and take them off and pickle them in formaldehyde in the Smithsonian and leave them in a bottle there. The code of ethics of the American Archaeological Committee was written in my living room by a dear friend, Allison Wiley, who's a philosopher of archaeology and was working with a another historian of archaeology who teaches in the neighborhood there. And so in this case, the research must be designed to answer questions that both groups want answered. That's one powerful form of it. So the significant issue here, one significant issue, is that the researcher has to give up intellectual control of the research project. So as I tell my graduate students, you may not do this for your dissertation. You can do it after, maybe. But there's nothing worse than an ill-informed researcher trying to collaborate with some vulnerable group. And we want you to know how to actually organize and control a research project so you can make an informed decision about what forms of that control are appropriate to give up and what forms are not. There actually, in the natural sciences, is a whole wave of citizen science or civic science movements that do much the same thing. I bet you there are plenty of them around Oxford, as a matter of fact. They tend to, in the US at any rate, every disease has lots of citizen science groups. Breast cancer survivors, parents of kids with autism, you name it. And there are citizen groups that are highly motivated to understand everything they can about the particular malady they're dealing with. And they recruit scientists. They either change their own biographies, as so many of the AIDS researchers did. They turned into AIDS researchers from other histories. Or they recruit scientists to change their research biographies and attend to autism or whatever the issues are. So these citizen science or civic science movements tend to cluster around medical and biological issues, around environmental issues. David Hess has led the way in articulating a chart of the different kinds of these movements. The Berkeley physicists, for example, refused to do atomic research, nuclear research, many decades ago, and that was one of the first of these big such movements. Today they're all over. So, as I said, this is a second kind of new proper scientific self, a strategic researcher who positions his or her research project firmly in existing social relations rather than trying to get outside of them. The third kind, I'll just briefly mention. Bill, what do I have, 10 minutes? Yeah?
15.
15? Okay.
Don't you like?
Yeah, raise the chart when I keep going when I'm not supposed to. The third one I want to mention is knowers who are both individuals and collectives or communities. One quite well-known example of this is Rigoberto Menchu. How many know who she is? She won the Nobel Prize many decades ago for her account of how the federal government, was it in Guatemala, I think, highly supported by the US CIA, had been killing her indigenous groups. And so she was in Paris and gave an interview to a French journalist, and that became the book, I, Rigoberto Menchu. And she talked about how she had been shot at by these CIA federal people attacking her people, how she'd been dispossessed from her household and so forth. And I think he was a British anthropologist, actually. I don't know if he was British, maybe he was American. Took her on and said, after she won the Nobel Prize for this book, and said, these things did not happen to her. She's lying. And there was a huge discussion, to put it mildly, went on in anthropology and elsewhere for a decade. And it turned out that what she represented as happening to her had happened to her brother, to her uncle, to her community. And after 10 years, the original critic agreed that her book had been truthful in a sense that was not recognizable by standard Western standards. Her sense of self was not an individual self, but as a member of a community, right? And women have always had something of this, because we're never Sandra Harding, we're Mrs. somebody or other. Harding actually is my father's name. We're Mrs. somebody or other, or the daughter of somebody or other, and we have an we're required to have often a moral identity as representing the whole community, not just the individual. Honor, there's issues about honor killings and so forth. So this kind of issue leads us to see that what creates knowledge is not individual practices, but those that are produced in the context of and shaped by a larger community. So those are the three I talked about there in the book, each of which in some ways, in important ways, is opposed to Mr. Nowhere. I'm working now, appropriating from anthropology's interest in the ontological term. And I'm just going to say a couple things very briefly about it. The strategies I articulated are all about epistemology. They're all about the knowing process. They don't focus on the world known, right? The world that one is trying to understand. The ontological turn points out that insofar as they stick to the epistemological level, they fail to engage with the nature-culture divide that has been so damaging to modern Western research, in which those who can claim nature on the side of their claims are considered the real knowers, and those who can't, those who present cultural beliefs, are producing inferior knowledge. And so the ontological turn says, how can we learn to live with different realities respectfully with people who live in very different realities than the ones we live in? They put it in terms of learning to walk with others respectfully, even though one disagrees with their assessment of what the world is that they are walking through. A most obvious example of this is religious beliefs. Many cultures live in the time of the gods, as theorists in this field have put the point, in which gods or spirits are active agents in the world. Mountains have effects upon people's actions. Spirits do things. They shape the world and people's beliefs. And some of the significant figures here are the Brazilian anthropologist Eduardo Viveiros de Castro, who's been in lengthy conversations with Bruno Latour, the French anthropologist and science studies scholar, Maria de la Cadena, Maria, she's got another name in there, de la Cadena, who writes on environmental issues. But this notion of multiple ontologies has appeared in Northern works also. For instance, Peter Gallison, whom I quoted in opening, with philosopher David Stump, edited a collection of papers called The Disunity of Science. And it showed how sciences are not coherent wholes, but rather aggregates of different pieces that conflict with each other, and they're disunified in a variety of ways. More recently, I think his name is Ed Kellert, Helen Longino, and I forget his first name, Waters, edited a collection called Scientific Pluralism. And again, it's a very interesting look only at northern sciences, as Gallison and Stump were only looking at northern sciences and technologies. Kellett, Longino, and Waters are looking at pluralism within, you know, some biological theorists don't understand other biological theorists at all. They work in very different worlds, and the worlds they work in respond to the kinds of questions they have about the environment. I mean, we can understand that if you think of the effect of the environmental movement on how we understand the world we live in, right? We conceptualize it very differently from before the environmental movement appeared. For example, we didn't used to think of it as a spaceship or a lifeboat, where some people would be thrown off, right, because for environmental reasons. So this ontological turn I'm suggesting produces another kind of proper scientific self. There's a lot more to be said about it. I'm just gesturing toward it here. It produces a pluriverse, a world of multiple worlds. I think of them, being a well-trained philosopher, in terms of Venn diagrams, right, where there's some overlap, but there's a lot that does not overlap. And it's very, to respect that difference and yet be able to communicate and function in the world is an important activity that's widespread, but that modern Western science frequently fails to recognize. So to conclude, the dominant philosophy of science that many of us grew up in and that still prevails was developed actually only in the 1940s and the 1950s. There's a terrific book that describes this by George Reich. It's entitled How the Cold War Shaped Philosophy of Science, Transformed Philosophy of Science, to the Icy Slopes of Logic. And it's a study of the correspondence between Carnap and Reichenbach. And I can't resist mentioning that when I first came to UCLA, I occupied Carnap's office. And my philosophy of science teacher had been a student of Carnap's. And on, I don't know, October 23rd or whatever each year, I took every course I could with him, just because he was so good. October 23rd each year, we'd have a moment of silence to commemorate the birth of Rudolf Carnap. And there I was in his office. And Reichenbach had come over in 1938, I think it was, to UCLA and brought a whole stream of the logical positivists who had been the Vienna Circle into UCLA and into US. The analytic philosophy of science, that's the dominant one in the sciences as well. I mean, when they bother to articulate it, they frequently do violate it in their practices, thank goodness, but when they articulate it, that philosophy actually emerged only when the Jews and the socialists, which is who the Vienna Circle was, encountered McCarthyism in the Cold War, didn't like commies and was anti-Semitic to boot. And so they pulled back their highly socially and politically designed research to the icy slopes of logic. They shaved off all the social and political aspects of it that they felt they had to do in order for them individually to survive and in order for their philosophy to proceed. But you know what? This is 2017. That's 70 or 80 years ago. The Cold War has ended. I hope McCarthyism has disappeared, but in the US we have some doubts these days about it. At any rate, we need philosophies and methodologies of science that work for us in the worlds we live in, which are very different from that one of the 1940s and 50s. And we need to relink philosophies of science and scientific practices to democratic goals, namely those of social justice movements. Thank you.